in chapter 3, Krishna has described working without attachment to the results of work. Karma is work. And the fruits of work is phala, the Sanskrit word phala means fruit. So detachment from the fruits of work. Karma phala, tyag. Detachment from the fruits of work comes by you work, and there's the fruit of work, and you offer the fruit of your work to the Supreme. By offering the fruit of your work to the Supreme, there's no bondage, because karma is like a double-edged sword. Work and reactions to work. What you do comes back on you. That way. So one can work karma-free by what's taught in chapter 3. And when you work without attachment to the fruits of your work, but offer the fruits to the Supreme, in that spirit of detachment, something very nice happens. A number of very nice things happen, but one of them is the capacity to understand things, like subtle things, like spiritual things, becomes enhanced. Do it the other way. Those who work with a strong attachment to the fruits of their work, they can't understand subtle things. Spiritual subject matter is elusive. No, do it the other way. By learning chapter, by practicing chapter 3, is preparing the reader, or Arjuna, the listener, to understand finer things of transcendental knowledge. So in chapter 4, Krishna begins introducing a little bit about himself, his position in transcendence, because he's before Arjuna, appearing to be, in other words, part of this world, but the fact of the matter is he isn't. We have this saying, he's in the world but not of the world. He's not worldly. He's transcendental. His personality is transcendental. His qualities are transcendental. His name is transcendental. His form is transcendental. He's transcendental. But persons who are, go back, attached to the fruits of their work, they can't grasp that. Even if they hear it, they can't. It slips right through their fingers. They can't get a hold of it. So in chapter 4, Transcendental Knowledge, Krishna is disclosing things about himself and other, besides himself, things that are of the transcendental plane of reality. And then he says some very nice things about one who is situated in the boat of transcendental knowledge can easily cross to the other side of material existence, the ocean of material existence, just by getting on the boat of transcendental knowledge. And then he gives another metaphor. The fire of transcendental knowledge can consume unlimited amounts of fuel, the fuel of one's sinful reactions, just by being situated in the fire of transcendental knowledge. So it's, and there are other examples to help one understand. It's, you can't say that about, you know, being a walking encyclopedia. You don't transcend sinful reactions, or you don't cross over to the other side of material existence. It's not that kind of academic knowledge, it's transcendental knowledge. It has a special potency. He's inviting Arjuna and us, you'll come on over to the boat of transcendental knowledge. So in the beginning, that was just to get everybody with the book in their hand. Now it's chapter 4, where in the beginning verses, from what I understand, the first 4 verses are covered. these first four verses, Krishna is describing how transcendental knowledge comes into this realm. So the picture is truth with a capital T exists before there's creation because it's eternal. Creation comes into being, stays for some time, and it goes out of being. But transcendental knowledge...
He's saying that it's 441.
441.
Yeah.
That's a change then from... Okay, fantastic, 441. So let's just do the preliminaries. Transcendental knowledge comes into this world by a system of descending knowledge. Through, it's called disciplic succession, or succession of disciples, from teacher to student. The student becomes a teacher who then has students, and those students become educated, so they become teachers, and then they have their students. And in that system of disciplic succession, Krishna introduced transcendental knowledge into this world. And then he tells Arjuna, he gives the line, I spoke to the sun god, Vivasvan, and Vivasvan spoke it to his son, Manu, and Manu spoke it to his son, Ikshvaku. And in this way, the knowledge that came from the transcendental realm is now in this realm. But when that disciplic succession became broken, the knowledge was lost. So now I'm coming and teaching you, starting afresh, this disciplic line. And in this way, transcendental knowledge is to be received. In other words, it's not an ascending process. It's a descending process. Knowledge comes from transcendence. You could say from the perfect person, meaning God. Knowledge, if you want perfect knowledge, get it from a perfect person. Then you get perfect knowledge. You want imperfect knowledge? Take your pick. There's a lot of imperfect persons that get knowledge from imperfect persons, and you'll get imperfect knowledge. But if you want perfect knowledge, the perfect person, or in this line of disciplic succession where it's unbroken, unchanged knowledge. And when that succession is broken, the knowledge is lost, so Krishna is reestablishing by speaking Bhagavad Gita. And he explains in this chapter, from time to time, he comes and does the same thing. When there's discrepancy in those teachings, dharma syuglani in Bhagavad Gita, discrepancies in dharma, Krishna comes and he reestablishes it. So that's at the beginning of the chapter. Now I was told we're at text 41. So let's look at text 41. We recite the verse. 41. It's almost at the end of the chapter. Yoga, sannyasta karmanam, jnana, sanchina, samshayam. Atmavantam the karmani, nibhadnanti dananjaya. Translation with a short purport. One who acts in devotional service, renouncing the fruits of his actions, like chapter 3, and whose doubts have been destroyed by transcendental knowledge, that's chapter 4, is factually situated in the self. Thus, he is not bound to the reactions of work. O conqueror of riches, purport. One who follows the instruction of the Bhagavad Gita, as it is imparted by the Lord, the personality of God himself becomes free from all doubts by the grace of transcendental knowledge. He, as a part and parcel of the Lord, in full Krishna consciousness, is already established in self-knowledge. As such, he is undoubtedly above the bondage to action. To speak about this briefly, and then, because it's such a short purport, we'll speak of the last verse also, 42. Prabhupada spoke like this about self-realization. self-realization and God-realization occur simultaneously, just like the rising of the sun and seeing oneself. Because of the light of the sun, you can see yourself. Or, say it the other way, when it's night and there's darkness, you didn't pay your electric bill or something, you know, the lights are out, you can't see yourself, nor can you see the sun. But when the sun comes up, you can see the sun, and you can see yourself. And similarly, as the sun gradually rises, so similarly, God-realization is gradual, and self-realization is gradual. They go parallel. But one without the other is not God-realization or self-realization, because the nature of the self is, in fact, in relation to the Supreme. It's just like the particles of sunshine and the sun, or the sun rays and the sun. Has anybody here seen some sunshine where there isn't a sun? The answer is no, because it doesn't exist. Or have you seen a sun where there's no sunshine? No, the answer is no, because they're inseparable. Similarly, self-realization implies, it's implicit. It implies God-realization. Now we'll be explicit. Self-realization means there must be also God-realization, otherwise it's not self-realization. There's an organization, when I was a young college student looking around to see what was out there in the spiritual marketplace, and there was the Self-Realization Fellowship. And a couple of things that I just intuitively didn't feel comfortable about, and one of them was, what's the self without God? No, thank you. I can find that, you know, at the university. I don't need to go to a self-realization fellowship where you can say you have self-realization. I studied those kinds of things in psychology classes, and, you know, self-actualization or self-realization without God. No, thank you. Because self-realization implies God-realization. So what Krishna is saying in this verse is there's two parts, and that's, it's just bringing in what's the previous knowledge of chapter 3, working, performing your prescribed duty. You have a nature, we each of us have a psychophysical nature. We have a body, we have a mind, and it's unique. It's the psychophysical nature, it's ours. And we can use it. In fact, we don't have a choice but to use it, because we're animate beings. We're going to do some work. And from that work comes some fruit. Now, what do I do with that fruit? If I'm attached to the fruit, it's bondage to the laws of material nature and karma and the whole program. So if I don't want that whole program, then detachment from the fruits of work by offering the fruits of the work to the Supreme. But then comes a big question, who or what is the Supreme? Good question. And so transcendental knowledge tells one, what is the Supreme, or who is the Supreme? How do you identify the Supreme? That's disclosed in chapter 4. So this verse, Krishna is putting the two together. Detached work, karma palatyag, working without the attachment to the fruits of your work, and divyam jnanam, transcendental knowledge. Who is the Supreme unto whom you offer the fruits of your work? When you are situated in that way, those two components, Krishna says, you're situated in self-knowledge. You're self-realized. It happens as naturally as the sun rises. You can see yourself. You don't need something extraneous. The sun rises, and you can see yourself. So one who situates one in those two things, and it's, you know, it's easy to say it, it's another thing to do it. I mean, I'll just spend a little time with either one of them. Like working without attachment to the fruits of your work. What's that look like? What does that feel like? And what's that? It's one thing to say it, but even when one takes up spiritual practice, there's the tendency to think, I'm going to do it. I did it all along. Since I was like a little one. I learned how to, you know, mommy said, you know, tie your shoes. And so I learned how to tie my shoes. And then, you know, learned 1 + 1 = 2. And I learned it. And, you know, I all along I've been learning, you know, the ascending knowledge process. So now I come into the spiritual thing and I'm going to apply the same methodology to the spiritual thing. And it doesn't work. It's just it's descending knowledge. And so I'm attached to this idea of I'm going to do it, the Sanskrit phrase in the second chapter, karta aham. I'm the doer. Karta aham iti manyate. It's the cloud of false ego that covers the conditioned soul. So even you're trying to become a spiritual personality, you take that tool called false ego and try to do it. You don't get there by that tool. It's false ego. Something material doesn't get you to the spiritual position. You have to like change the channel. And it's descending knowledge channel, the Krishna channel. And with knowledge of Krishna and working without the striving for that knowledge without the sense of I'm going to do it. It means I have to be in receiving mode. There's something that I do. I strive. That's what souls do. That's what we're animate beings. The soul is conscious and consciousness. So we're exercising consciousness, directing it towards the Supreme. But we'll say it this way. It's not like finding the sun is a matter. You get a very powerful flashlight and I'm going to go find the sun. That's not how you find the sun. The sun is self-luminous. Yes? So put your flashlights away, the ascending knowledge system away, and receive the knowledge of Krishna from what he's given in Bhagavad Gita. It's the English term, or maybe it's a Christian term, is revealed scripture. Like the Bible is called revealed scripture because what it's revealing is God. God reveals himself through scripture. So explicitly, this is Krishna. There may be some other scripture that I'm not aware of, but as far as I'm aware, this is the only scripture where God speaks, I am this. There are scriptures that speak third person. He is like that. This is where God is saying, I am like this. It's pretty special. And it must be received by disciplic succession. But if you receive it by disciplic succession, you can have these two things, at least an opportunity to become free from attachment to the fruits of your work by offering the fruits of your work to the Supreme and knowing who the Supreme is and having some attachment and identification and affinity for the Supreme. And then you have self-realization because you also have God-realization. So let's see what Krishna says in the final verse of the chapter. Text 42. Tasmat means therefore. Agyana sambhutam vitstam jnana sandhatmanaha chitvainam samshayam yogam atishto tishta Bharata. Therefore, the doubts which have arisen in your heart out of ignorance should be slashed by the weapon of knowledge. Armed with yoga, O Bharata, stand and fight. Purport. The yoga system instructed in this chapter is called Sanatana Yoga, or eternal activities performed by the living entity. This yoga has two divisions of sacrificial actions. One is called sacrifice of one's material possessions The other is called knowledge of self, which is pure spiritual activity. Same as the previous verse, repeating, there's what you think to be yours and what you think to be yourself. So I and mine. Sacrifice in both categories. Self-conception and proprietorship conception, mine. Two different types of sacrifice. When you offer the fruits of your work unto the Supreme, that means the mine conception becomes, it's His. And then you have to work on the self-conception, because otherwise you can't do the other one properly. That was chapter 2 also. But self-conception is made complete through God-conception, self-conception. So having sacrifice of the misconception of self and receive the proper conception of self, and then the mind, what's proprietorship? Let me give it to the Supreme. It's the property of the Supreme. It belongs to Him. Let me offer it to the Supreme. Because where did the ability to work come from? From God. Proof. He can take it away. Just like that, it's gone. Or the things that we're working with to produce our work. Where do those things come from? From God. Proof. They can just be taken away in a flash. You could go through that process and look and see what's mine. And the answer is nothing is mine. Then if it's not yours, then who does it belong to? It belongs to God. Some of you may know the Upanishads or heard of the Upanishads. One of them Prabhupada translated, and what I just said is the first verse of Isha Upanishad. There's the Isa Vasya, the God is the proprietor of everything, and we're living in this world, and He's making provision for our necessities. So we can accept and utilize those things that are necessities, and it enjoins, and don't take more than that, knowing to whom it belongs. It's meant for someone else's maintenance and their provision, just like a mother and father will provide for their dependents. So supposing one of the dependents takes everything on the dinner table. It doesn't leave anything for the other dependents. That's not okay. Because there's something for everybody. So accept what is your necessity that's provided by God. Anyway, two types of sacrifice. But one who performs such, we'll go back up. If sacrifice of one's material possessions is not dovetailed for spiritual realization, then such sacrifice becomes material. Like just giving things up. Not for spiritual realization, just to give things up. It's called the renunciation of a monkey. Markata Vairagya, or Palgu Vairagya. But one who performs such sacrifices with a spiritual objective or in devotional service makes a perfect sacrifice. When we come to spiritual activities, we find that these are also divided into two, namely understanding one's own self or one's constitutional position and the truth regarding the Supreme Personality of Godhead. One who follows the path of Bhagavad Gita as it is can very easily understand these two important divisions of spiritual knowledge. We discussed that already. For him, there is no difficulty in obtaining perfect knowledge of the self as part and parcel of the Lord. And such understanding is beneficial. For such a person can easily understand the transcendental activities of the Lord. In the beginning of this chapter, the transcendental activities of the Lord were discussed by the Supreme Lord Himself. One who does not understand the instructions of the Gita is faithless and is to be considered to be misusing the fragmental independence awarded to him by the Lord. In spite of such instructions, one who does not understand the real nature of the Lord as the eternal, blissful, all-knowing personality of God, it is certainly fool number one. Ignorance can be removed by gradual acceptance of the principles of Krishna consciousness. And that's not using the term in a sectarian, it's speaking in a being conscious of God. By following the principles that deliver consciousness of God, awakening of that reality that God exists and we're connected to Him eternally. Speaking of that in terms of principle. Krishna consciousness is awakened by different types of sacrifice. To the demigods, sacrifice to Brahman, sacrifice in celibacy, in household life, in controlling the senses, in practicing mystic yoga, in penance, in foregoing material possessions, in studying the Vedas, and in partaking of the social institution called Varnashram Dharma. All of these are known as sacrifice, and all of them are based on regulated action. But within all these activities, the important factor is self-realization. One who seeks that objective is the real student of Bhagavad Gita, but one who doubts the authority of Krishna falls back. One is therefore advised to study Bhagavad Gita or any other scripture under a bona fide spiritual master with service and surrender. A bona fide spiritual master is in the disciplic succession from time eternal, and he does not deviate at all from the instructions of the Supreme Lord as they were imparted millions of years ago to the Sun God, from whom the instructions of Bhagavad Gita have come down to the earthly kingdom. One should therefore follow the path of Bhagavad Gita as it is expressed in the Gita itself, and beware of self-interested people after personal aggrandizement who deviate others from the actual path. The Lord is definitely the Supreme Person, and His activities are transcendental. One who understands this is a liberated person from the very beginning of his study of Bhagavad Gita. For those of you that are familiar with chapter 4, we just got a gloss of chapter 4. Because there's a whole big section on sacrifice. Now, sacrifice, the word itself means different things to different people. It symbolizes difference. It doesn't different things to different people. It doesn't mean like it hurts. Not that kind of sacrifice. You know, like an animal sacrifice or human sacrifice, or not like that kind of thing. Sacrifice means relinquishing, or even more etymological, rendering sacred. Sacrifice, rendering as the principle, rendering unto the Supreme. Rendering, making something that's on this plane connected to the spiritual plane, rendering sacred something that's here. And Krishna says that that principle of sacrifice needs to be applied in someone aspiring for spiritual life. You need to see things that are worldly, because that's the atmosphere that we're in, and see how to make these things that are worldly connect to the otherworldly realm by sacrifice. It's described in chapter 3 also. Let's go through a little bit, because I don't know all of you, so I'm doing simple things. We'll have some time for some questions at the end if you want to go in a different direction. Krishna describes in chapter 3 something that is being expanded here in chapter 4, and that is a dilemma. So the dilemma is, we're a spirit soul and we're in a material atmosphere. How do we get out of the material atmosphere? Because the dilemma is, I may think, well, as soon as I do something that's work, then there's bondage to work. So I do something and there's a reaction to that something. So I get another reaction, And with that, another body collectively over so many actions and actions and up to the end of my life, then I'm going to get another body, get another birth in material existence. So somebody might think, here's the solution. I just won't do anything. In Sanskrit, it's called karma sannyas. Renounce work. But Krishna says, that's not an acceptable solution, because we're going to do some work, because the soul is active. And the modes of nature are impelling us into action. So it's both internal and external. We're going to do something. So do something, and you're in bondage. And you can't do nothing. Damned if you do and damned if you don't. So what's a nice fellow to do in a situation like that? And Krishna gives the solution. Sacrifice. That's the path out of the bondage of work, or the wheel of birth and death, samsara. It's this channel of sacrifice. So he describes it in chapter 3, and then in chapter 4, he develops it further, where he states the principle again, and then says, some people like it this way, some people like it that way, some people like it the other way, and the other way, and different people, according to the modes of nature and one's past work, guna and karma. Some people, there's different models. Pick your model. But make sure you get the principle right. The principle is two things, sacrifice unto the Supreme, and the goal of which is to understand who I am. Not like just to get free from the bondage. Because that's, there are the liberationists, or salvationists, or those who are striving for moksha, that's their aspiration. They want, it's selfish. I want no bondage. There's bondage, and here's a path for no bondage. Well, what's it about? It's about me. And, you know, my material situation. So that selfishness is not liberating. It's still binding. It's just the flip side of attachment, is aversion. Doesn't bring liberation. One can think oneself liberated. There are verses in the Bhagavatam that describe that. One can think oneself liberated. Go ahead, think yourself liberated. And even one may be very elevated in that thinking of oneself liberated, but the Bhagavatam says that person will again, as Prabhupada says here, fall back or fall down to the material position of doing something because the heart hasn't become yet purified. The intelligence hasn't become yet purified. And what's the purified heart or purified intelligence? To understand what is the Supreme. Therefore, chapter 4 is here. To give us that clear understanding where Krishna is disclosing who he is. And he is disclosing the means for understanding who he is. Means is this method of receiving knowledge through disciplic succession. Now, supposing I'm a stubborn person. I know a few stubborn persons. Supposing I'm one of them. And I want to do it on my own. I was like this. You know, I don't want to take anybody's word for it. I want to experience it myself. That's nice. But experience it for yourself requires receiving knowledge through disciplic succession. When that light goes on, okay, I'm making some effort, but the effort isn't a solo effort, it's a descending knowledge effort. When that light goes on, you have to do something. And we were discussing this in the car on the way as a postdoc fellow researcher at MIT, saying, you know, it's really tough because I've been trained in this other paradigm of using intelligence to get the thing done. And I've been like how many years on the rock pile getting trained up in this system. And now you're introducing this descending knowledge system. It's a challenge. You know, I have to switch back and forth between what I was trained for so many years and now hearing descending knowledge. So my answer was, yes, it takes a greater intelligence, a different kind of intelligence, but even a greater intelligence, because the current is moving very swiftly. in a direction, and spiritual life is moving against that current. Your intelligence has to be greater. Of course, Krishna gives the intelligence. It's not like, okay, I'm going to do it. I'm going to have greater intelligence now. It's not that kind. It's the descending knowledge kind of intelligence. It's intuitive, but it's also intelligence. And a devotee needs to have that, like, you know, be able to make that discrimination, that discernment between ascending and descending knowledge. And when it comes to Krishna, it's descending knowledge. You use the faculties that God has given you for certain. Your discriminating powers, use them. But use them to see that the necessity of descending knowledge, if you want to understand God, who is beyond the faculty of material energy. There's a verse in the Brahma Samhita that states it very nicely. I'll paraphrase it because we have some new people here. Supposing you built a spacecraft, and you have two models. One that can travel as fast as the wind, another one that can travel as fast as the mind. And you strap yourself into that spacecraft, and you travel for millions and millions and millions and millions of years, and the spiritual realm is far beyond, because it's beyond the capacity of the mind, because the mind is a material energy and the object is the spiritual energy. It can't reach there, no matter how good you are at speculating. The ascending process won't get you there. Pantastu koti sarasam bhagamyo bayor atapi manaso manipungavanam. It's not going to work. But there is a way it can work, descending knowledge. That's what's laid out in this fourth chapter. Now the conclusion is, with that in your pocket or under your belt or, you know, in your heart, having that capacity of descending knowledge, now, my dear guests here in the temple room, perform your duties in life. Go out there and be transcendental. Don't be like, I mean, it's not like a condemning. It's don't be in dull consciousness, be in Krishna channel consciousness, be in this descending knowledge of Krishna while you perform your prescribed duties. It's doable. The Bhagavad Gita is a manual, it's a how-to manual. Like, you know, when you buy an electronic something, a gadget, it gives you a little manual, how to use the gadget. Push these buttons and things will happen. So Bhagavad Gita is a manual. How to use this human form of life, where there's the soul inside and then there's this machine. How do you use the machine and how do you use the soul inside? Direct it in such a way you get to the spiritual reality. Just use the user's manual. It'll get you there. And there's these different, so just to repeat, there's different elements. Possessions are like stuff, like, you know, gross physical objects and how to properly relate to them. And then there's you and how to properly identify self and how to use both the self and stuff in sacrifice to the Supreme. How to identify the process, how to identify the Supreme, how to properly relate to stuff and let go of the false ego thing of thinking, okay, now I'm going to do it. And work in a different manner, empowered by this descending transcendental knowledge. That's then Krishna's pointing to the battlefield, to Arjuna. There's life. You have your psychophysical nature. Use it. Do your prescribed duty and always think of me in transcendental consciousness. That's the simple message. And this message is simple, the application is a little difficult because we're conditioned. But the message is simple. The complexity comes because of our conditioning. But if you hear the message carefully, try to apply it carefully, side by side, chant the Maha Mantra very attentively, cleanse the heart, Jetho Dharpana Marjanam, so that in that cleansed state of heart, the message, descending message, can come in and touch your heart, and then the light goes on, oh, that's what it meant, and then you can go into the field of your life, activity, and be Krishna conscious. Every moment. Regardless of what your occupation is, or anything material, doesn't matter. Your age, the language, the culture, the background, doesn't matter. Principle, apply. I just have to be a spirit soul. I think that's all of us. You're qualified. So we have 10 minutes before the... Yes?
Maharaj, regarding the question that was asked last night...
Which one?
The question was integrating God and government. I relayed that to my husband, and he said that I should ask this on his behalf, which is, how is this possible to integrate God and government when there are... The vast majority are not favorable to a descending process. The vast majority would like to have that kartaham. They would like to say, I want to reach God on my own, I have my own concept of God. Therefore, how can you create a universal view that works for everyone?
Well, thank you for that question. The Bhagavatam supplies the answer. Because the Bhagavatam asks the question too. And in short, it's through Bhagavad Gita it becomes possible. So what can you and I and, you know, concerned, thoughtful persons do? We can promote Bhagavad Gita. And now how receptive are, what to speak of government leaders, even, you know, people in general, how receptive are people in general going to be to hear that sacred sound vibration? Very few. And so, what's the likelihood of a God-conscious government today? Not very likely. That question is a predictability question. But that wasn't what you asked. You asked, how can it be done? That's how it can be done. That's what the Bhagavatam asked that question. The sages ask the question. And Śrīla Gosvāmī gives the answer. In this age of Kali, just after the setting of the sun of Krishna on the western horizon, shortly thereafter, on the eastern horizon, came the moon, as brilliant as the sun, in the form of Śrīmad Bhāgavatam. And in this way, religious principles will be upheld. So what we, you and I and the rest of us need to do is promote that light that's as brilliant as the sun. The Srimad Bhagavatam and its message. And one of the ways to promote it is to live it. And then another way is give people the opportunity to read the literature or to come and hear the topics being discussed and so on. Now, you know, predictability, Krishna gives that the answer to that one in Bhagavad Gita. And that was 5,000 years ago. Out of many thousands of persons, maybe one will even ask the question, who am I? What's reality? And of those who have achieved perfection, hardly one knows me in truth. So, here's the good news. There's a whole collection of statements by Srila Prabhupada saying, in order to change the complexion of the complex world in which we live, it's not that everyone must be Krishna conscious. He said if 10% of the population became Krishna conscious, the world would be a different place. We could have this God-conscious government. Because yadyadacharati shrestas tatidvi tirorajana. If qualified persons set by right example, others will see this is a good example. That's the method, at least, endorsed by Sunta Goswami and Srimad Bhagavatam. We have a challenge in front of us. It's a big mountain. Yes, in the back.
You say that everybody has to be Krishna conscious. But isn't the essential truth of all religion to love the Lord thy God with all thy heart?
Sure.
And soul and neighbor
sure. Do you see a contradiction in those two?
No, I don't.
Good. I don't either. We're on the same page.
Right. So what I'm saying is that when we promote Bhagavad Gita, we should also, when especially for the Western world, it's very nice to present also a Christian or a Judeo-Christian similarity, because that's what people are familiar with. And they're familiar with Christ's teachings, and Christ's teachings go parallel with Krishna's teachings.
It's a teaching of bhakti.
Yeah.
As is Bhagavad Gita, the teaching of bhakti. There's not only symmetry, it's the same message, as you pointed out. So, now let's address, because you invited me to do so, I'll address your question, why emphasis upon Krishna? Because, there was a time, like you probably, I had never even heard the syllables. Krishna. I heard what you had said. When I was a little anecdotal, when I was, the other half of that is love thy neighbor as thyself. So I was this teenage boy attending confirmation classes when I was 13 in a Protestant church and asking myself the question, how do I do this? Because this is a principal teaching of Christ. And I couldn't figure out how to do it. And I became very frustrated. And I would ask other people, including the priest and, my Sunday school teacher and the confirmation class teacher and other, how do I do this? And I didn't get a clue. I mean, I got a pat on the head and, seek and ye shall find kind of an answer, which was nice, so I continued to seek, but I didn't get an answer. And then some other things happened and I got distracted and went off to college and, forgot all about that nice message. But when I came in contact with Bhagavad Gita as it is, I read 7 translations of Bhagavad Gita before this one. But when I read this one, it became very clear what it meant. And it had to do with the second chapter of Bhagavad Gita, that understand the self, the neighbor, to be the soul. It's not like that wasn't in the Bible, but I didn't get it. No one pointed it out to me either. The love goes to the soul, not to necessarily the covering of the soul. Because my thing was, there are people that do some really unlovable things, and I'm supposed to love those persons that do these very harsh, hurtful, unlovable things. I honestly don't love that. And that person. Because I was thinking of the person in terms of the covering of the person, the covering of the soul. I didn't have a spiritual conception. Not that it wasn't there in the Bible. Just like, anyway, I didn't have a teacher that could lead me to that understanding. But this did. And now, one more step. Love God. Well, with all your heart, mind, and soul. How do I love somebody if I don't know who they are? It's tough. I can, say I should love them because they're lovable. That's nice. Tell me a little bit more. And in that, I'm being, because of time, we're in 2 minutes, the conscience is going to blow. In Bhagavad Gita, I found out a lot more. And then continuing with. So There's the personality with a form and qualities and pastimes and loving exchanges. And, you know, I love Krishna. That doesn't mean I don't love God, or I rejected the teaching that Christ gave or put it in the back burner or something. I'm doing it. And I'm loving my neighbor as myself, because now I have a better understanding of who my neighbor is, instead of, you know, in a physical bodily conception of self. So it's not dogma or sectarian. It's God is a person. And somebody likes Allah, that's fantastic. And somebody likes Jehovah, that's fantastic. They like God, you know, the form of God, name of God, and qualities of God, fantastic. But he's a person, and I like the name. It's the same person with a different name. But I, you know, Krishna, the name Krishna means the all attractive. And, you know, I'm attracted to the all attractive. I'm doing those things. So it's not to the exclusion of, it's, you know, including those things. And I have, you, if you could imagine, I travel a lot and I always dress like this. How many questions do I get about, you know, what's your religion, what's your beliefs, and, you know, I've got a different one, and how do they compare? Discussions like that all the time. Like, all the time. And it's, this isn't a, so the message is not a sectarian message. It's a principled message. And part of the principle is God is a person. And it's 7 o'clock. Is the pujari ready for arti? Where's her? Yes? So I'm going to end. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki.